Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Pete Musto, Dorothy Gundy, John Russell, and Jill Robbins. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Pete Musto.
The police chief of the state of Alaska's largest city hurried out of his department's glass building during a major earthquake not too long ago. Telephone communications failed to work, and even police radios were having problems after the earthquake. But Anchorage Police Chief Justin Dahl's mobile phone had recently been connected to a national wireless network designed for emergency workers. Dahl was able to reach other officials who had the new high-speed connection after the 7.1 magnitude quake last year caused widespread damage. It proved to be the first major test in Alaska for the FirstNet network. Dahl and other commanders had just agreed to take part in the test with their personal mobile phones. The important calls, made possible by FirstNet, helped emergency workers set up an operations center and organize the response to the November 30th earthquake. It was just random chance that we had started sort of testing this a little bit right before the earthquake happened, Dahl told the Associated Press. He said he felt better providing the system to his department, knowing that it had worked well in an emergency. Anchorage Police officially joined the service in January. They are among thousands of public safety agencies nationwide that can use the connection during emergencies and for normal work. This includes communicating by smartphone, directing officers to calls, and looking up suspect information in the field. Agencies also can tie the network to software programs on their phones known as apps.
In Alaska, the network is seen as a new tool to connect emergency workers in a huge state with many Native American communities far away from roads. High-speed internet has been built in hard-to-reach areas in recent years, but connecting those communities is still difficult, even with FirstNet. The network is secure, encrypted, and cannot be used by the public. But it has raised concerns among media activists that the secrecy protects police and others from criticism. This comes as more agencies cut off their traditional radio communications from the public. Both FirstNet and telecommunications company AT&T, which runs the high-speed system, say users must open parts of the network. However, the communications company did not know of any agencies that had done so. Launched last year, the United States Congress established the network in 2012 as a result of the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks. During those attacks, some police and fire departments could not communicate with each other over different radio systems. The First Responder Network Authority is an independent federal organization that oversees the network with AT&T. The organization plans to invest $40 billion over its 25-year agreement with the U.S. government. the U.S. was the first to roll out a government-supported wireless network for emergency responders. Nations like Australia, South Korea, Canada, New Zealand, and the United Kingdom are studying FirstNet as they look to create similar services, said spokeswoman April Ward.
Verizon has rolled out a similar service for first responders not tied to the government, but would not say how many agencies use it. More than 7,250 departments nationwide have joined FirstNet, AT&T said. Chris Sambar is AT&T's senior vice president for FirstNet. He said more than half of the system has been completed. In Alaska, the five-year goal is to build the network to cover more than 90% of the population. But the FirstNet plan noted that still represents less than half of the state's spread-out tribal lands. For now, nothing will take the place of Alaska's mobile radio network, said John Rockwell. He is a state official who worked on the plan. I really believe in FirstNet, he said. It's just not there yet. Hal Louder is city emergency manager for the small community of Whiteville, North Carolina. He said the town lost all connections except for FirstNet when Hurricane Florence hit last September. Even FirstNet started slowing down when officials tried to send large amounts of data. So they turned to a tool available to all users of the system, equipment that turns a satellite signal into a mobile phone tower. It worked perfectly, even at slow speeds, Louder said.
Increasingly, police radio communications are not available to the public. A growing number of agencies, including Anchorage Police, do not permit others to listen to police radio. They say it is over safety concerns. But this removes a traditional resource for reporters and others. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Pete Musto.
The American television series Seinfeld was famous for its unusual and often strange conversations. These conversations often took place in a diner, a kind of small, informal restaurant. In one program, the character George is sad about where he is in life. George feels that he has made poor choices. He wants to change his life around by doing the opposite of what he has done. He would like to eat different foods, be willing to talk to strangers, and so on. Let's listen to a few lines from the show.
Well, here's your chance to try the opposite. Instead of tuna salad and being intimidated by women, chicken salad and going right up to them.
Yeah, I should do the opposite. I should.
If every instinct you have is wrong, then the opposite would have to be right.
Today, we will explore the idea of opposites. Namely, we will look at words that have at least two meanings, one meaning and an opposite meaning. We will also explore disputes around these words, like one involving the word literally.
English has a number of words with opposite meanings. They are called contronyms. You will hear contronyms in the news, official speeches, and everyday conversation. You will even see them in writing. Consider the word sanction. A sanction can can be a kind of punishment for disobeying a law, especially an international law. Imagine you hear a news story about the United Nations Security Council. The story might begin with the words, "Security Council votes to impose sanctions." If you follow the news, you are probably familiar with this expression. However, the word sanction can have an opposite meaning, an official approval for an action. For example, you might read a news story about a legal dispute. The story might say, "Critics say the policy lacked legal sanction." In this case, the critics are saying that the policy did not have official approval, because sanction has a second, opposite meaning. It is a contronym. Here's another example of a contronym, the word bill. You can have a $50 bill, or you can receive a $50 bill for medical services. In the first example, bill means a piece of paper money. In the second case, bill suggests a document that tells you how much money you owe.
Americans sometimes dispute the use of a contronym. Consider the word literally. On the internet, many stories and videos are sharply critical of this word.
A lot of you out there who say literally don't seem to understand what literally means.
Literally, in its traditional meaning, means by the letter. It later took on the meaning, with the meaning of each word given exactly. Americans often use it in a completely different way. Imagine you hear the following conversation.
Did you hear Tom's story?
Yes, I was literally dying of laughter. It was so funny.
Here, the second speaker does not mean that she is dying. When she says literally, she means figuratively. The word literally is like the character George from Seinfeld. Literally, like George, spent time doing one thing. Now, it is looking for a change. Naturally, the word itself is not making this decision to change. English speakers are using the word in different ways. There is nothing new or strange about this change. Many words change over time, just like people and societies.
John McWhorter is an expert on languages. He notes that English speakers use some words for what he calls common social uses. He refers to these uses by the acronym FACE. Do not worry about all of the terms. The one we are interested in is the letter F in FACE. It means factuality. McWhorter notes that English speakers use words to show how truthful or exact their statements are. In other words, they include words to show how factual their statements are. Literally has become a word that shows factuality. It shows that the speaker is using an overstatement or exaggerated language. So when a person says, "I was literally dying of laughter," they are using the word literally to show that they are using exaggerated language. If you compare this use of literally with the first definition of literally, you will notice that literally has become a contronym. McWhorter notes that this is a natural progression for the word. There is nothing wrong or incorrect about this change, he adds.
The next time you are listening to an English speaker or reading a document in English, look for examples of contronyms. If you are having trouble understanding a sentence, it might be because the speaker or writer is using a less common meaning of a word. try to think about the word's context. Sometimes you can understand a contronym's meaning by thinking about the other words that come in the sentence with it. Contronyms are a strange, fun part of language. They are literally the easiest thing about the English language.
I think you are exaggerating. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Today we continue the story of America's 36th president, Lyndon Baines Johnson. Johnson was vice president to John F. Kennedy. Kennedy was murdered in Dallas in November of 1963. Johnson served the last 14 months of the president's term. Then he won a full term of his own starting in January 1965. Most of Johnson's time and energy would be taken up by the war in Vietnam. By early 1964, America had about 17,000 troops in Vietnam. The troops were there to advise and train the South Vietnamese military. Vietnam had gained its independence from France in 1954. The country was divided into North and South. The North had a communist government led by Ho Chi Minh. The South had an anti-communist government led by Ngo Dinh Diem. In 1957, communist rebels, the Viet Cong, launched a violent campaign in the South. They were supported by the government of North Vietnam and later by North Vietnamese troops. Their goal was to overthrow the government in the South. President Johnson believed that the United States had to support South Vietnam. Many Americans agreed. They believed that without American help, South Vietnam would become communist. There were concerns about the so-called domino theory, that if South Vietnam fell, other Southeast Asian countries would also fall to communists. As Johnson began his full term, his military advisors told him the communists were losing the war. They told him that North Vietnamese troops and Viet Cong forces would soon stop fighting. On February 6, 1965, however, the Viet Cong attacked American camps at Pleiku and Quinon. The Johnson administration immediately ordered airstrikes against military targets in the North. Some observers in the United States questioned the administration's policy. James Reston of the New York Times, for example, said President Johnson was carrying out an undeclared war in Vietnam. In March 1965, the first American combat troops arrived in South Vietnam. Congress supported the president's actions at that time. However, the number of Americans who opposed the war began to grow. These people said it was a civil war. They said the United States had no right or reason to intervene. For 6 days in May, the United States halted bombing of North Vietnam. The administration hoped this would help get the North Vietnamese government to begin negotiations. The North refused, and the United States began to build up its forces in the South. By July, 125,000 Americans were fighting in Vietnam. Some Americans became angry. Anti-war demonstrations took place in San Francisco and Chicago. More and more students began to protest. They wanted the war to end quickly. Some people thought the anti-war demonstrations were only delaying peace in Vietnam. James Reston believed the demonstrations would make Ho Chi Minh think America did not support its troops. And that, he said, would only make him continue the war. In December of 1965, the United States again halted its air campaign against North Vietnam. Again, it invited the North Vietnamese government to negotiate an end to the fighting. And again, the North refused. Ho Chi Minh's conditions for peace were firm. He demanded an end to the bombing and a complete American withdrawal. Withdrawal would mean defeat for the South. It would mean that all of Vietnam would become communist. President Johnson would not accept these terms, so he offered his own proposals. The most important was an immediate ceasefire. Neither side would compromise, however, and the fighting went on. In 1966, President Johnson renewed the bombing in North Vietnam. He also increased the number of American troops in South Vietnam. ...1966 was also a year for congressional elections. The opposition Republican Party generally supported the war efforts of Lyndon Johnson, who was a Democrat. But it criticized him and other Democrats for economic problems connected to the war. The war cost $2 billion every month. The price of many goods in the United States began to rise. The value of the dollar began to drop. Americans faced inflation and then a recession. To answer the criticism, administration officials said progress was being made in Vietnam, but some Americans began to suspect that the government was not telling the truth about the war. Opposition to the war led to bigger and bigger demonstrations. In July 1967, just over half the people questioned for opinion surveys said they did not approve of the president's policies. But most Americans believed that Johnson would run again for president the next year. Johnson strongly defended the use of American troops in Vietnam. In a speech to a group of lawmakers, he said, "Since World War II, this nation has met and has mastered many challenges. Challenges in Greece and Turkey, in Berlin, in Korea, in Cuba. We met them because brave men were willing to risk their lives for their nation's security. And braver men have never lived than those who carry our colors in Vietnam at this very hour." The price of these efforts, of course, has been heavy. But the price of not having made them at all, not having seen them through, in my judgment, would have been vastly greater. Then came Tet, the Vietnamese Lunar New Year, in January 1968. The communists launched a major military campaign. They attacked 31 of the 44 provinces of South Vietnam. They also struck at the American embassy in the capital, Saigon.
Military police got back into the compound of the $2.5 million embassy complex at dawn. Before that, a platoon of Viet Cong were in control. The communist raiders never got into the main chancery building. A handful of Marines had it locked and kept them out. But the raiders were everywhere else.
CBS News reporter George Sievertson described more of the fighting in Saigon and how it affected civilians in a poor part of the city.
This neighborhood is called the chessboard because of the maze of alleys and passageways. Its residents are mostly poor working people, and its slums are a refuge for Saigon's hoodlum and criminal elements. Vietnamese Rangers and Marines moved carefully, blasting buildings and possible Viet Cong hiding places before moving ahead. This was the first time heavy fighting has taken place in Saigon proper. Until now, most of it has been in the Chinese section of Cho Lan and in the suburbs. The VC were difficult to dislodge. They obviously knew the section well and had built barricades in key spots. The Rangers and Marines took casualties, mostly from hidden snipers. As soon as a section had been cleared, more terror-stricken civilians scurried out of their homes. Thousands of them fleeing from the bullets and explosives, and even more dangerous, a fire that began to rage out of control. Residents in nearby buildings began dragging their most precious possessions out of their shops and homes. Saigon's water supply system is operating only at 70% of normal, so fires are a serious menace. For these people, many of them who fled the war from outlying villages, this is the cruelest blow. The curfew has kept them from making a living. Food prices have tripled since the fighting began a week ago. And now, their homes are being destroyed.
Thousands of people were killed in the Tet Offensive. The communists suffered heavier losses than the South Vietnamese or the Americans. But many Americans were surprised that the communists could launch such a major attack against South Vietnam. For several years, they had been told that communist forces were small and losing badly. General William Westmoreland, commander of U.S. military operations in Vietnam, spoke with reporter George Sievertson.
General, how would you assess yesterday's activities and today's? What is the enemy doing? Are these major attacks or...
The enemy, very deceitfully, has taken advantage of the Tet Truce in order to create maximum consternation within South Vietnam, particularly in the populated areas. Now, yesterday, the enemy exposed himself by virtue of this strategy, and he suffered great casualties.
As a result of the offensive, popular support for the administration fell even more. Democrats who opposed President Johnson seized this chance. Several ran against him for the party's nomination in 1968. These included Senator Robert Kennedy of New York and Senator Eugene McCarthy of Minnesota. Kennedy and McCarthy did well in the early primary elections. Johnson did poorly. At the end of March 1968, the president spoke to the American people. He discussed his proposal to end American bombing of North Vietnam. He talked about his appointment of a special ambassador to start peace negotiations. And he announced his decision about his own future.
I do not believe that I should devote an hour or a day of my time to any personal partisan causes or to any duties other than the awesome duties of this office. The presidency of your country. Accordingly, I shall not seek and I will not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
Another major issue facing America in the 1960s was the civil rights movement, which sought to ensure equal rights for black Americans.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.